Everyone, if you guys can get to your seats, I'm ready to start the long talk, lecture, speech thing, I don't know. before we get too far though, I would like to start with prayer, if that's right, and I'll try to make it quick. Dear Lord, thank you for everyone here. Thank you for this time to talk with each other, and I pray that it would be a good time, we'd learn, and that it would be communicated effectively, and that what would be shared would only be good. In your name I pray. Amen. Amen. All right. So, the first question I want to deal with is, what is worldview? Because it's a word we hear thrown around a lot, especially in this environment, right? It's worldview night. So, what does it mean? Well, basically, it's kind of what it says. It's how you view the world, what you think of the world around you. What's interesting is... in the Bible, the word for world, the Greek word is cosmos, from which we get cosmetic. It means order or arrangement. And that's actually a really helpful way to think about it when you see it in worldview. It's the order around us, because there is an order. We see there's not just chance. If we believed that there was only chance, we wouldn't be here tonight talking with each other and interacting. No one can really live like they don't believe in reason exists. So the first question to what is worldview is, it's what we believe to be true. So there's kind of an issue here where sometimes we think we disagree because we use different expressions or different terms. Those would be the symbols we use as opposed to the actual meaning. You can use all the same symbols and mean totally different things, and you can use totally different symbols and mean the same thing. It's kind of a weird dilemma. But the essence of an individual's worldview is what they mean behind it, which is how it practically, it's the foundation for it, and it's how it practically plays out, what it looks like to live this belief. If you believe in something that has no remote application to reality, you don't really believe it. The only things you believe are things that you really believe are things that affect you in some way, how you think or how you act. Just saying noises doesn't make it a belief. So symbols, well, they can be good for clarity, and when we need them to communicate, just like every word is a symbol, it's the meaning behind it that matters most. Next thing is, what must it be? And this is where things are going to get complicated if we run ahead too quickly. So I want to try to keep this simple. The fundamental question to what must it be is, what are the different beliefs, right? How many different worldviews can there be? And the deeper the question, the more it can divide or unite a worldview. So the deepest question there is there truth? Is there such a thing as actual being? Is there a pure truth? Or is this all just insane? Well, if there is no truth, then it is not a true statement that there is no truth. Which means that it's impossible to have no truth. That's subjectivism, the belief that the world is just however you want it to be. That's just silly. No one can really live like that's true, because then if you did, you wouldn't have to pay taxes. You wouldn't have to suffer. It would be an awesome world to live in, until you realize that other people do bad things, and also you aren't perfect, so you're going to want the wrong thing sometimes. So not only is it illogical, but it would be a horrible and impractical system. So if there is truth, what is truth like? A lot of people will jump the gun on what it is. They'll say it's this, they'll say it's that. Some people say God, some people say there is no such thing as God. Ultimately, I would agree that truth is God. I am a Christian, and I believe that quite firmly, if it's not obvious from the prayer. But proving that is a different story. So as a matter of how we can go about proving truth, we can make guesses. But at the end of the day, until we use some infallible reasoning without fallacy in it, some deductive reasoning, we don't really know a whole lot about what makes truth truth. So the first thing to consider is, what does it mean to be? Because I call truth pure being. It is the thing that must necessarily actually exist. That's what makes it truth. So the simplest way I can think to explain it is, nothing exists in total isolation. Nothing's completely alone. and something can't actually exist if it's completely alone. And that might seem perplexing, but I think it's very easy to prove. When you define something, when you say what it means, you have to relate it to something else. And while you can describe qualities about something, those qualities are only understood in relation to the meaning that we have either experienced or heard about in relation to something else. So everything exists in relationship. So what this tells us is that truth is relational, and truth must also, by its nature, if it is truly the ultimate thing, it is the foundation for all things, must not be dependent on anything. It must be self-existent, so that would be aseity, not being dependent on anything else to exist. This would be necessary reality, as opposed to contingent reality, which would be like the existence of birds. Birds really do exist. I mean, some people think they don't, but they do exist. And we know they really exist, they truly exist, but they're not a necessary reality because the rest of the world, logic, reason, does not depend on the existence of birds. Reason is older than birds. We don't need birds for reality to exist. But what that tells us then is that truth must be able to have relation with something that is somehow distinct, but it can't be dependent on anything outside of itself. That's a really strange dilemma. And while it is difficult to imagine, it is not a logical contradiction to say that truth has relationship within itself. That it is one thing that has distinction in itself. And this deals with the issue of why is there diversity and yet uniformity in life. You can think of types and archetypes if you're familiar with that terminology. You can have, let's say this square represents an archetype. That is the epitome, or it's technically a rectangle. It represents the epitome of any given type. You can call it whatever you want. And you could have a four-pointed star. And you could say, well, that is a type because it has those four external points. But this is still the archetype. And you can have all sorts of variations on the archetype. But ultimately, truth would have to be the greatest one there is, and it has to have self-relation. That is something I'm going to get into a little bit more later, but that's important to know for now. The existence of contingent reality, that would be all of us, we began to exist at some point, meaning that we are contingent, not necessary. So that's something very interesting about truth. It tells us that truth has free will. And that might seem odd. How is that jump? How do we get from free will in truth, suggesting it to be personal, which relational also suggests personal, because anytime there's a relationship, there's some personal involvement. And while you might say, well, physical objects relate, only because ultimate truth relates them. Truth's the groundwork for reason, it's the groundwork for reality. So the laws of physics that govern our universe that cause things to relate, that's only because truth is there to hold them together. You can't escape that because the moment you take truth out of the equation, it's not truly anything. So it's really important to understand truth, ultimate truth, as the literal foundation for all things. The moment you try to get away from that, you get into this subjective loop of nonsense. And it becomes unintelligible. It doesn't mean anything. So going back to why I said free will. If we are contingent, we're not a logical inevitability. There is nothing that in the laws of logic that dictates we must exist as a matter of necessary reality. Now, we evidently can prove we exist. We know we exist. Otherwise, we wouldn't be talking about ourselves. We couldn't be here reasoning. But for us to be not necessary, but to exist, means that logic, it obviously has to exist, but there must be something that can act without being forced to by the laws of logic. There must be some form of action. And hence we have truth as having free will. Now, we can get into our own free will, and we can argue back and forth, does man have free will or not? But you can't live like you don't have free will on some meaningful level, because we make choices all the time. So it's interesting that man should reflect a quality of truth. In fact, man reflects many qualities of truth in his relational qualities. Not that he's self-relating, but that he can relate with other men. He can consciously relate things. He's uniquely intelligent. And he can use reason. So, where do I want to go with this? I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought. Give me a second. So there's, obviously, like I said, there's a discussion of whether or not truth is God. And you have a few different views on God, or theologies, right? Your knowledge of God. Theos being God, ology being knowledge, the study of. So you have pantheism. You have atheism. You have polytheism. And you have monotheism after that. Blank on the word I was writing. So, you have the belief in everything being God. That's what pantheism is. Pan is all. And theism is God-ism. It's the belief in God. And then atheism, A is a negative, so it's no God. Polytheism, many gods. Monotheism, one God. Well, if this is any relation to God at all, we can't have multiple ultimate truths. That's an irrational statement. Now, atheism and pantheism are kind of interesting because, they seem like total opposites, everything's God and nothing's God, when you eliminate the definition for God by saying he's everything, you no longer actually have a meaningful purpose behind the word God. Think about if I said everything was blue, blue wouldn't be a meaningful term. You couldn't practically employ it in any way. So these are actually two sides of the same coin. Pantheism and atheism are the same. And what's interesting is if you look at the beliefs for the origin of the universe, they believe the same thing. And this is where it gets really weird. It's two variations of the same story. In atheism, the current scientific consensus is that nothing, under intense gravitational forces, don't ask where they came from, split into positive and negative matter. Nothing split into negative and positive. And that is their logic. And it's the same thing for pantheism, is they believe that this nothingness, which they would term God, normally with a lowercase g, there's a couple variations, but it's the same basic narrative, is this nothingness split into everything, and we're basically in some sort of illusion with this fluxation of up and down, negative, positive, matter or antimatter in a materialist view. Atheism is just materialistic pantheism. Pantheists are just sometimes spiritual, sometimes material. They're the same religion. They have different forms. They will fight with each other on some issues, but the reality is they believe the same thing. They're the same worldview. And in the end, they believe we're going back to equilibrium, which is nothingness. So there's some optimism for you. Go live that life out. Don't think any of us can. Don't think any of us want to, even if we could. So that kind of disqualifies those views and leaves us wondering about monotheism. I've heard a lot of objections to monotheism. I haven't heard a lot of good objections to monotheism. A lot of people will present what's called the problem of evil. How on earth can there be a good God and allow suffering? And I get it. This is not the best experience. This life has lots of good things, but it's got lots of horrible things. There are terrible crimes happening all over the world, half for centuries. So why doesn't God stop it? Well, I have a question for you. Have you ever done evil? Have you ever done evil? Have you ever done wrong?
Yes.
What if God stopped you? Suddenly the problem of evil looks like a lot like mercy. It turns your perspective and you say, well, yeah, but those people are so much worse than I am. And the question becomes, what is your standard of right and wrong? And where does it come from? Does it come from a purely logical, non-subjective, not religiously influenced right and wrong, but just your conscience, or maybe it's about not hurting other people. Well, we've all hurt other people, but there is such a thing as God. And we have rejected his will and his love. If we have turned our backs on him, is there a greater sin than that? Can there be a greater evil than that? It's hard to imagine. But then we say, well, if God's real, why don't I see him now? Why doesn't he just show me who he is? If there is this ultimate truth, and it is all these things, and it's more than just drawings on a whiteboard, what does it look like? Well, I'd suggest to you that there is 2 or 3 dozen proofs of God in this room right now. And I don't mean these kinds of arguments. I mean personal proofs. I mean the things you can walk up to, you can talk to, you can shake their hands, you can ask them how they're doing, you can pick their minds. Because as a Christian, I believe we're image bearers of God. And I don't believe that that's something you need the Bible to prove. Now, the Bible, I think, proves it and explains it and talks about it very deeply and meaningfully, and we definitely should use the Bible. But outside of the Bible, you can learn a lot of this. First of all, like I said earlier, we are unique to truth. We have reason in a way that no other creature really does. I hear people talk about how octopus and squid and other creatures like that are supposed to be very, very smart. But the truth is, none of them developed computers. None of them have developed planes. None of them have given lectures. Not that you need to be smart since I'm doing this here, but they aren't like us. Now, they're great creatures when they don't try to kill us, but they're not like us. We are unique in some creative and constructive ways. And that leads me to think that we have meaning. And that's something you can live out. It's hard to live out some days. Some days it doesn't feel like you have meaning. But feelings did not enter into the equation of what is and isn't true. Only logic tells you for a fact what is and isn't true. Now, you can have feelings that might lead you the right way, but ask anyone who's ever lived by their feelings their whole life. It doesn't work too well. They might insist that it's the right thing to do, but I guarantee you they're miserable if they've really lived by their feelings. There is not a happy man who lives only for his feelings, because feelings come and go. Feelings aren't stable. Truth is stable. Reason is objective. But we're not so objective. We kind of like to bend reason certain ways. We like to warp it. That's not it's not so good, but we do that. But going back to truth, what we know about truth, it's relational, it's self-existent, and it has free will because there is a contingent reality. And without free will, the contingent reality, it'd be the same as the necessary reality. That's just a fancy way of saying the unneeded and the needed reality. What we have to have and what is allowed to happen, but doesn't have to happen. If you get rid of free will and you say that everything, absolutely everything, has to turn out in an exact way as a matter of logical necessity, you have actually removed the category of contingent or unneeded reality and made it part of necessary reality. And now everything is equally necessary, and you're right back to pantheism, where everything is necessary truth. You also can't live that out because you entertain hypothetical thoughts. Now, I don't mean can't live it out like it's a challenge. For example, we can't live perfectly morally. And you might say, well, how you prove that logically, but I'll win that bet every time. Find anyone who says, I'll live perfectly for a day. You can bet as much money as you want. You will find something they did wrong, even if it's in their thoughts, if they're being honest with you. Because we all do things wrong. And we know we do. But that doesn't mean it doesn't mean that there isn't then real morality. It doesn't mean that we can't trust the belief in objective right and wrong. It means that we can't be the ultimate standard. That's funny. Truth keeps coming back. That's the only thing that can be the ultimate standard for holding our universe together. That's in relating to itself and in relating to the contingent reality, which must necessarily exist, and that is the foundation of free will. Is that truth willingly created something. Now, truth being unchanging, I'm just going to give a bit of backstory. I've been entertaining these kind of discussions and thoughts for a couple of years, just two or three, not a lot. But recently, I've taken advantage of the existence of AI, and I've gone back and forth with it in a couple of conversations. It's a lot of fun to convert it. Obviously, it doesn't have a soul, and it can't say, well, yes, I'm a Christian, because it's like, well, no, I'm a computer. I can't religiously anything. I don't have... But you can persuade it, and I've done this three or four different times, that there is a God, that Christianity is the only logical religion, ultimately, and that God must necessarily be Trinitarian. And that's not just because I'm crazy smart. A lot of this was me experimenting with thoughts I had heard before from other people I listened to, because other people can reason because they have that relationship to truth that we all have in some degree or another. You could think of reason as a unchanging avenue through which we can talk to truth. For all the different ways we might feel distant from it, we might be distant from it, there is a constant lingering presence in reason and in the mind. The Bible says that God has written eternity on our hearts, and I believe that very, very strongly. But once again, you don't need the Bible to prove a lot of these points. So, shoot, I lost my train of thought. Right, so the debate with the AI. I actually had a little bit of trouble with it regarding free will. Because it said free will... means that something has the ability to choose something. And if truth is constant and unchanging and eternal, as it must be, if it's really ultimate truth that supports everything, then how on earth can it have free will? Because free will is a necessary ability to change. And it was kind of an interesting conversation, because I got to say that contingent reality exists, and contingent reality needs free will to exist before it exists, because something has to choose to bring it into existence. But the only thing that precedes it is the needed reality. But needed reality, it said, can't have free will. And it was a very interesting dilemma, but the fallacy is in the definition of free will. Free will does not require change. If you choose something and you commit to that choice and never change on that, you've never changed, but you chose something. And that also... that has some big implications, because if truth chose creation, or I suppose at this point I haven't proven it's created. For all we know, it could co-eternally exist with truth from this line of reasoning, but I'll get into why I think it's necessarily created later. Obviously from the Bible we know it's created, but once again, not everyone believes in the Bible, so proving these things without the Bible as a matter of necessity is kind of the whole point of apologetics and most of this conversation. So... contingent reality, I'm just going to write CO for now for convenience. It's something that truth voluntarily made and wants. But we do see a disruption in order. Now, truth is not disorderly. That's the reason we know contingent reality must have some free will actor. Well, that's interesting. There's a whole lot of free will actors in the contingent reality in this room, isn't there? So once you get into contingent reality, you're not on the same grounds as in necessary reality. This has to be the case. This is pretty likely the case, but this also includes the area of science. Science isn't infallible, and the popular idea today that science can be trusted blindly is ludicrous. Science is a wonderful thing. Thank God we have it. Thank God he gave it to us through the form of men believing that there is truth and order in the universe, which not a lot of people today know. Science was a system developed by Christians. There were methods of study before, but not as nuanced, not as robust as the scientific method. Now, a lot of people say, well, everyone was Christians at the time when history just progressed to science, but it's also no coincidence that history was making major progress when so many people were Christian. It's worth considering, and it's a really interesting study to get into. Going back to the contingent reality, sorry if I ramble. I kind of go back and forth with my train of thoughts. They are connected. So you gotta focus on it, but I do get a little lost sometimes in my thoughts. So contingent reality, it's something truth wants and something truth made, but for some reason it's different than truth. There is disorder. Well, what do I believe? What is my worldview? How do I explain this? Well, as a Christian, I believe in the Bible. And I do believe God made the world. And I do believe it's fallen. Now, what I said earlier about man being representative, or not representative, being like God in certain capacities is always finite. There's an infinite gap between the necessary and the contingent, right? Contingent depends, necessary has always been. There is this unchangeable gap in this unbridgeable gap in the nature of these two things. You can never make it so that contingent reality is necessary reality. That cannot logically be. It would be a meaningless statement. However, when you make a personal contingency or contingent thing, there's a difference. Because in personhood, you can relate no matter how different your nature is. If you are both rational and intelligent and intelligible, you're capable of communicating. And the thing is, truth's infinite. We may be finite, but truth is infinite, and that means truth has the ability to communicate things in ways that we can meaningfully understand, though we can't fully understand it because we're finite, right? Basically, we have little minds. Ultimate truth, by definition, can't be confined. It can't be a little mind. But it can say little words for our little minds. This is really nice. Because definitely needed that a lot. But yeah, that personhood bridges that gap. It shows that there is meant to be some relation, which truth doesn't need, by the way. Truth's fulfilled in itself. It's got. It's gone. It's got a relator, the three necessary elements. It has the related to. And it has the relationship. Or the relation, you might say. Now, in Christian theology, it is not hard to connect that to the Trinity at all. It's pretty quick. If you look into what's called the ontological Trinity, that's a really, or economic Trinity, I'm sorry. Ontological is the being, so ontology is the study of being. Ontological Trinity is the being of the Trinity, or the idea that there's three persons in one being, that's the basic idea. The economic trinity, economics is interaction, ecosystems, and all that. It's the basic idea is how things relate to each other. So it's very interesting that a core Christian concept should be found in this. Like I was saying, you have the Father, the Son, and the Spirit. And in Scripture, if you look, you will see the Spirit. Not just the Holy Spirit, which is the title of the person given in the Bible, but the spirit of man, it's linked to two things, breath and relationship. It is a connecting thing because through our breath we speak. We need breath to have words. Try holding your breath and speaking, it doesn't work too well. What you see is that the Father, the terms, they're kind of complicated. We don't have to get into them tonight. But in short, the theologians would say the Father begets the Son eternally. Not that he's caused or created, but that there's this eternal relationship where the Father begets him. And then the Spirit is sent of the Father by the Son. So that's why we have that order of first, second, and third in the Trinity. They're all equally God. They're all essentially God. They all have the nature of God. They're one being. But there are three relations within God, which explains how he can exist within himself. You will not find another religion that is monotheistic and has a multi-personal God who is eternal, unchanging, and omnipotent. If you find one, let me know. I don't believe there is one. I've only ever heard of one other religion with any trinity at all. It was a Native American religion, and it was polytheistic. They did have a monotheistic resurgence, and they may have believed in a monotheistic trinity for a brief amount of time. that may have been, I don't know for a fact, but that could have been essentially a pre-Christian break in breakout or revival in a way in the Americas, because that was before any of the Christians came. And that would make sense within a Christian worldview, because we believe God is the God of all things, not just the God of the Christian religion. We don't look at it like, well, he's real in our hearts and in our churches and in our Bibles. And then in the world, it's like, yeah, but we're just like everyone else. We can live like that sometimes. That's not Christian lifestyle. That's not what you should do if you believe Christianity. Now, don't get me wrong. If you believe Christianity, you're not going to be perfect. None of us are perfect. If you believe Christianity, you're going to believe you're forgiven. Because that's what the core of it is. And that's really what cries out to me in the contingent reality being chosen by God. We have disorder. That means our free wills are necessarily at odds with truth, because we choose disorder. And you might say, well, some of us do and some of us don't, and maybe that's the case. But if we have any difference at all in our orderliness, not in trivial matters like what flavor we like, but what we believe is right, then someone's in disorder. We can't all be right. That's back to this nonsense.
Just so you know, way back, gosh, I think I worked on this probably before the Civil War happened. But,
just a few days ago.
Yeah, I was in college, you know, 1977, 1979 time frame. In my searching for what was going to be my reality and religion, I explored to see if I can find another religion which had a monotheistic God, but three relational personalities. I couldn't find one, so I gave up on that. And then I went to try to see if I could find one that was monotheistic that had dualism.
Ah.
I couldn't find that either.
Dualism is an interesting topic, and it's actually not different from pantheism. Remember what I said about positive and negative?
That's
dualism's...
It merged into the same.
Yeah, it's yin-yang. And really what all those other religions boil down to is truth, yes or no.
Yeah.
That's why I say that must be, because when you get right down to the logic of it, they're either monotheistic or they're whatever madness else is going on.
Do you think that perhaps the reason why we struggle, and maybe even the AI struggle with thinking that truth can free will, is that when we immediately, like the first time you mention that, I'm thinking, oh, well, you can choose something good or you can choose something bad. But in reality, if you're truly good, you could choose multiple good things.
Right. Free will is not intrinsically a moral issue.
Right.
Yeah.
I can choose to walk in any area of this room. Now, it might be considered rude if I go and leave the podium while I'm supposed to be giving a speech, taking up other people's time. But my ability to choose where I go or what I do with my time or words I say, right? There's lots of things I can say that are fine, lots of different ways I can say the same thing. But those aren't wrong things. And this is what happens when we don't take something at its strict definition. That's the meaning, the essence of something, what it relates to, how it relates. And ultimately, everything's going to relate to truth if it's real. If it has no relationship to truth, I mean, by definition, this isn't an opinion, this isn't dogma. By definition, it's not true. The very idea of true is that has some relation to truth.
Yeah. Just want to interject something. Matt, there's a fundamental fallacy which cannot be overcome at this point with AI. And no one who is developing AI or studying it has faced this yet. We can develop technology through software which approaches truth, okay? Because truth has a directional metric. But there is no way to use a computer or software or anything else to extract from, we'll call it for now, we'll just say the universe, something which is the most powerful of all forces in the universe, and that's love. Okay? Love is the most powerful force in the universe. And that's why we're directed through many religions to try to use love to knit society together. And it's even coming to the point now where people who are learning to measure the vibrational frequency, it's multiple, and it's actually a combination of what's called beat frequencies, but it's possible to start measuring the transfer of love now between people and between people and dogs. And it's looking like the future of that is everything transmits love to some extent, tree to tree of the same species, insects of the same species. It looks like that vibrational characteristic we refer to as the emotion of love is everything. It's knitting everything together, and AI can't do that.
I'm not sure how you can measure that. I'm not sure how that can be a meaningful thing. Maybe it's something I haven't thought about yet, but AI fundamentally falls short. Actually, I'm really glad you brought that up.
Yeah.
Is because truth, like I said earlier, it's personal, right? We're contingent, it's necessary. There's this massive gulf between us. Personhood restores that. AI can't get to truth, ultimate truth, which you were hinting at as being love, which is another conversation. It's very interesting. If you, we can do a brief summary of that. I'm already a little over half an hour in, so I don't know how much time I have. But when you get down to morality, everyone has a system of morality. Even headhunters and cannibals, we might not like that idea. We might say, "No, we're more sophisticated than they are." And yet we have abortion where we murder our children. Go figure. We're not all that much more moral.
Abortion. Like, the people in this room would never agree with that. So, I think it's important to separate.
Might individually not have it, but we definitely have our own sins. Okay. We definitely have our own families.
I feel like that's a different group than the group that's sitting in this room. That's what I'm saying.
Oh, yeah. No, I meant we, America, not... Okay. I'm referring to the mindset of a nation. I'm sorry. I didn't mean that to sound accusatory. But yeah, morality, at its heart, is a system of virtues or values. And you can value things that are not orderly. That would be like murder, headhunting, cannibalism. Those are horrible things we can all agree are wrong. They're disorderly. They're not how it should be. They're not in accordance with truth. And that actually, it's really funny when you think about it. Morality is values or principles, virtues, but they're things that, what, you value.
Ken, I'm sorry for interrupting. You wondering how much time you have, an hour is what we shoot for.
Gotcha.
Okay,
so I'll try to make it brief.
No, you're doing great. Really? I just want to answer your question, that's all.
I already set my alarm for 3 in the morning.
Can we make it 3:30? No. So,
push the envelope.
Morality breaks down to values, and values require person, and this is another proof for truth, by the way, and it actually goes back to relationship. This is the basic template for an argument, and you can rehash it in about 300 different ways. This is the basic necessity for truth to exist, but you also have the logic of God's all-knowing. He has a perfect knowledge of himself. This knowledge is not merely conceptual. It is an actual self-knowledge such that he has an image of himself that is real, just as he is, because he's personal. And that he communicates himself to himself, that would be the third person. So that's the moral, that's the logical necessity. Well, it's two logical necessities. And the third one's the moral. If he's infinitely good, he's the greatest good. Apart from contingent reality, aseity, right? He's self-existent. He must always have been loving. Love is not just an emotion. Love is a verb. It is an action. It's value. When you love someone truly, it isn't about how you feel, and it isn't about what you get out of it, and it's not about just what works. It's what's best for that person. And love is absolutely the most powerful weapon there is in very many real ways. It sounds very sentimental and like just a vague statement people make. We abuse the word love today. We use it to refer to debauchery and all sorts of stupid things. But true love isn't about the pleasure you get out of things. It's not about how you... It's not about you. That's what it boils down to. And for truth to always be perfectly moral, It must be communicating itself without dependency on the contingent. Because once it's dependent on the contingent, you break down a saying, you break down the meaning of truth. So you have truth must be relational. You have truth logically knows itself perfectly, and you have truth perfectly loves itself selflessly. And that can't be meaningful if truth doesn't have relation. Truth can't be meaningful without relation. So to actually affirm truth is to affirm relation. And what else is interesting is there's a very familiar pattern here. If you know grammar well, you have the subject, the object, and the verb. Every sentence we speak, every action in our lives where we do something to communicate something else, we're actually affirming the Trinity. No other religion has that. Your constant breath does not affirm Allah. It doesn't affirm Buddha. It doesn't affirm any of that. It affirms that there is something to relate and that relation is meaningful. And it affirms that there is truth, that truth is relational, and the implications, the result of that, is the Trinity. We're living as if the Trinity is true on some basic capacity, but then we, with our words, say, well, it's irrational. Three, you know, 1 + 1 + 1 doesn't equal one. It equals three. You can't think there's three and one. And well, I can think there's three persons and one being. That's not a contradiction. The only people who say the Trinity is illogical are probably the people who don't know the definition of the terms used. We're talking not the last 500 years of Christians saying, oh yeah, just accept 3 + 1 as a mystery, or 1 + 1 + 1 = 1 as a mystery of faith, that 3 = 1. No. For over 2,000 years, people have been debating the nuance, the meaning, and there is a widely agreed upon consensus for something so heatily debated. In other religions, when they debate a lot, they normally will disagree on even the core issues, but they will normally agree on some things to be the same religion, right? But if you disagree about some nuance about God in Islam, what are they going to do to you? Islam's not very nice. Lots of religions, they're like that. They're not very nice. Some are. Some are pacifistic. I don't believe pacifism can be remotely moral. Because you let other people die around you so you don't ever have to worry about putting yourself in their place. Violence can be sacrificial.
Can it be also not sacrificial?
It can be, yeah. Of course violence can be
abused. And still moral?
Can it be, well, is sacrifice the foundation of morality? Not the loss of it, but why you sacrifice. Value. I've also heard love defined as sacrifice, and that's because it's the same thing.
I just mean, can you have sacrificial violence without dying in the process?
Oh, yeah. Sacrifice doesn't have to mean death. It just can mean any loss. But yeah, so that's a good point. Is do you have to die? No, you don't have to die. Defending someone, protecting them, that's good. Protecting people's rights. This is why political involvement matters. Not that I'm going to be biased, but Republicanism is vastly superior. So,
you're not
biased. No, not in the least. It's logical necessity. No, I'm kidding. That's obviously in the contingent camp. God's not a Republican. He's greater than that. He's going to set up a monarchy. It's going to be awesome, but you know, not everyone agrees with that. But the Bible talks about it. It says that he will reign, and it'll be awesome. That's really how it's meant to be. Truth, in the best sense of the word, is a tyrant. Tyrant not meaning someone who abuses their power, but someone with absolute power. That's kind of what I've been trying to nail down. Truth's omnipotent. You can't escape that, because the moment something leaves truth, it ceases to be. That's the definition of the words.
So this a tyrant isn't someone who uses their power to oppress others?
Not classically. It became associated with that. But if you look into the original use of it, yeah, I believe it's Greek origin, and it was used just to refer to an absolute ruler. The Greeks were known for their political philosophies. They actually had the idea of a republic very early on. They also experimented with democracy, and they found out it was really stupid. Turns out, the majority will just oppress the minority every time. And history also bears witness. This is why republicanism is superior to democracy. I'm not saying, I don't ever encourage the dehumanizing of people. Democrats are people. Republicans, monarchists, they're all people. Yeah, and that's kind of one you don't hear about today. Monarchists aren't a very large group, but honestly, between a monarchy and a democracy, I'll choose monarchy any day. Because as broken as it is, there's a lot of value to having a head of the government and having someone who actually makes the choices. An individual who is accountable. You might think, we can think monarchies have no accountability, but that's not really true. Because when you're one person, if you really, really get everyone to hate you, you don't have the advantage if your army hates you. You're really only as confident as the loyalty of the people beneath you. But you know what? It exercised and demanded loyalty and virtue, which a democracy actually doesn't. Democracy encourages self-indulgence. It's off topic, but democracy says care about your own interests, fight for your own interests. I believe that there should be a balance of what the people say and the head of the government having a legitimate right. And that's why we have a republic. It's pretty awesome. Shame we kind of screwed it up. So anyway, truth's relational. It also created something, but it made a choice. It made the choice to communicate itself through creation, through contingency.
What is that?
This?
Yeah.
That's just CO. That's the shortened way of saying contingency or what's not needed. It's just me abbreviating it because it's a long word to write out every time. So maybe I should just say unneeded and it'd be easier for everyone. But it made that, and that means it had a purpose, and its purpose can never change, right? Because it freely chose it. No one compelled it. But it chose it, and we know that because we're talking about it. And we're here as a witness to truth's choice. So, what about the disorder? Well, truth can't be thwarted. It's omnipotent. It transcends time. We can't outlast it. It's more powerful than anything there is, by definition. And it's perfectly good, but we're still around. We're not perfectly good, so I guess that makes mercy a virtue, doesn't it? How do you escape that? It makes grace a virtue. We're given mercies when you're not given the judgment you deserve. Grace is when you're given something you don't deserve. That doesn't mean you did something wrong necessarily. For us to exist, we didn't do anything to merit it. That's grace. But if we do something wrong and he shows us mercy and grace, that's even greater. So it gives us some interesting virtues, mercy and grace. Lines up very well with a Christian view. But anyway, that means the contingency has an end. At the end of expressing truth and becoming orderly, which means there's necessarily a reordering of truth in some way, in some shape, in some form. And this is really the essence of what I believe, is that God bridged the gap by taking on the likeness of a created thing. That Jesus is God, and that he did live a real life, that the historical witnesses of him aren't fabricated, that all the people who died in the first century, many, many, many people died professing his name, swearing they saw him after his crucifixion, which is a legally recorded event, by the way. We know he died. We know who he died under. We know when it happened. We've got very good information on the death, the life, death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. And you can look up all sorts of stuff to get into this. The Case for Christ is a great movie. It's also a book to look into this if you want some specifics on that. Now, that is in the potentially wrong. This is, once you get to contingency, it is fallible. It is not guaranteed. But when you're over here, so I kind of bounce back and forth. So when I talk of strictly this, that is a matter of what has to be. So if I say something in here that you're like, hold on, that's not necessarily the case, feel free to raise your hand, call me out.
Is truth a concept?
Truth is, and that's basically what I mean, is that truth exists. Truth isn't just conceptual. It has to actually be, right? It is the very foundation of truth that it's being. Because if truth is just a concept, is that true?
I didn't say just a concept. I just said
right. Concept. There's a concept component to it. Are you a concept?
No.
Well, there is a concept of you. But it's the same way with truth. Truth exists. There is a concept of truth, but truth is deeper than a concept because truth is the foundation.
It exists because it's conceptual.
Oh, I see what you're saying. No, it's not physical. I would put the physical in the contingent.
How does truth...
Because the physical is subject to change. Truth can't change.
Free choice if it doesn't make decisions.
Because it made a decision, and it just stuck with that decision. And whether or not Whether or not we can understand why it has free will, we know it must if we're a contingent reality. If there is a contingent reality.
But if you're saying that it has free will, can you explain how?
Yeah, it has the ability to make a choice, and it made the choice. It could have chosen not to cause contingent, or it could have chosen to or not to, and it chose to do that.
I'm not following. All
right.
Doesn't it just exist naturally?
Truth exists intrinsically, right?
Right.
This doesn't exist intrinsically. This is contingent reality. This doesn't have to exist. This is the uncertain. This is the unneeded. This is us. This is birds. This is things that change. Truth can't change by definition. Otherwise, we run into the issue of nonsense. Mm-hmm. Circular reasoning. So, well, not even just circular, but self-refuting circular reasoning. It's basically every kind of fallacy possible to deny the existence of truth. You'll find that in every fallacy, it's basically what you do. All the core fallacies. The basic rule A equals A. It's a very common rule in logic. It's that A cannot be non-A. Because by definition, it's A. So, likewise, truth is always compromised in a fallacy that is necessarily wrong. There's degrees of fallacy. So, like, there's the kind of fallacy where this could be wrong, and there's the kind of fallacy where this has to be wrong. It will always be wrong to deny that something is what it is. You can say it's not what it appears to be, but it has to be what it is. That's just the definition of it. So, really, a large part of philosophy, we make it out like it's this mystic, distant thing. It's just the definition of words. The dictionary and the Bible are the two most powerful books in the world, the Bible being the most powerful, I would say. But those two things, more powerful than anything else in the world that you'll ever read. That being said, some books are really great because the dictionary is a very boring read, actually. As fascinating as a lot of the words are, it's a very boring read compared to something like Lord of the Rings. And by the way, fantasy reading can be good because it can encourage your mind to think more and in different ways, to encourage hypothetical beliefs or different ways things could be, right? It helps you to think more deeply, to connect things more. And it's enjoyable. We enjoy learning a good story.
Does truth mean it's right? Like...
Yeah. Yeah, truth is the standard for right. Anything that's true is right. And this is that standard. It's a pretty good way. You can think about it like this. Truth is the archetype, like we talked about earlier. And anything that has that is a type for truth, that has a quality like truth, is true. But it's not the ultimate truth. So it's true that 2 plus 2 equals 4. That is not the same thing as something that has a satiety, because those are all dependent concepts. Math is objectively true. Math has always been true. But the idea of 2 plus 2 equals 4 is dependent on the existence of 1, and that's dependent on the existence of meaning. So I do believe math's intrinsic. I believe it's always been because the infinite mind of God, and it being purely conceptual, it's always been understood by God. He knows all numbers. And math, by the way, is the purest form of science. It's the one kind of science that is infallible because it breaks out of the temporal mold. It's very interesting, but perfect math.
Only conceptual?
It has physical implications, but 2 plus 2 equals 4 has no physical essence.
Do you mean physical representations?
Yeah, it has physical representations. Okay. You can communicate it, you can see it, you can apply the principle, but 2 plus 2 equals 4 is not an object you can find somewhere.
And would you say truth is different in that it's not only conceptual like math is?
Yeah.
Why?
Because if it's only conceptual, then only conceptual things exist. Because it's the standard for existence. If you have... If existence isn't real, nothing really exists. If it's purely imaginary. Now, the way you used conceptual earlier, I almost wonder if you mean that it's simply not physical. I would say those are distinct categories, not physical and conceptual. Because conceptual is imagined, whereas I would say the spirit isn't necessarily something that's imagined. I do believe people have spirit. It's their life, living. They're
being
alive.
When I say conceptual, I don't mean imagined. I just mean it exists, just not physically.
Okay, then in that case, yes. Under that understanding, you could call truth conceptual. I would agree to that. It's just, see, this is where, what I mean about symbols and meaning, right? I'm thinking a different thing when you're saying that same word. It doesn't mean you're wrong. We're really meaning the same thing. We had actually agreed with that understanding. I was just getting the symbol mixed up in my own thoughts of what it was, because we use different symbols differently. And this is part of communication. It's part of working things through. We're not perfect.
So, Ken, a couple quick questions for you. So, you're cramming a lot in 1 hour, which you have to, because you can't really divide that up and make different lectures out of it, in my opinion.
It's pretty hard to do.
Correct. But you could divide that into separate essays, right? I see like 3 or 4 different essays here.
Possibly.
I think I personally see 3 or 4 different
right.
essays.
Yeah.
So on that same topic, you could add 3 or 4 essays on top of those 3 or 4 essays, right?
Okay, so we're talking about the found work of reason and reality?
I'm talking about this lecture. You could divide this lecture into like 3 or 4 essays.
Yeah, possibly.
I think you
could. Probably, yeah.
I believe
probably.
You could.
Or you could just go
and
then, half hour.
And then you could write 3 or 4 more essays going beyond what you're saying in this one particular lecture.
Right, you can expand it.
So you could do that, right? You could write those essays. You have that ability.
I have this issue with focusing and writing something. I actually have a book I want to write.
You focus great tonight, Ken. You could
no, I mean to write a book or an essay.
Okay, but so,
I got to work
so,
on that.
So,
it's
so,
a discipline
so you
thing.
See more ahead of that, right? Because you write those essays. That's a book.
Yeah.
Write a
yep.
book. Write a book for us.
Well, I have a different book I want to write.
Okay.
It's purely theological. It's something I'm really excited about, but I got to work on it.
You can also use speech to text to do your writing.
That's true.
Yeah.
I could.
It'd be very useful to you because you're very vocal. And you know, that might
it's okay. I don't have a big mouth. I talk a lot.
Yeah.
I've always had.
I mean, you know, it's the same for me. I've sat there for many, many, many hours of my life touch typing. But
yeah.
I'd much rather speak to a system that translates what I've said into text.
It almost replicates that personal interaction because we're naturally made to speak, not so much to write. But writing's good and it's important. It's
yeah.
you know how we have the Bible preserved. So I'm glad for writing.
But
I do appreciate
it's,
that.
It's possible to develop writer's block. It's not possible to develop speaker's block.
I've never been. You're right. I've never naturally stopped myself from talking a lot. It's very intuitive for me. The funny thing is, this is a random tangent. When I was little. All little kids do weird things, so I'm just going to come out and say it. Sometimes I would suck on my knee. I don't know why I developed this habit, but I would be like sitting. I'd have my knees bent, like held to my chest, and sometimes I would just suck on my knee. I could fit almost my whole knee in my mouth. So I know I have a big mouth. I always have. It's okay. I can live with it. But I do believe God can use that as clumsy as you can be sometimes. So where were we? Right. My belief about redemption, I do believe that this is a created thing, contingency. The two options, logic or potentially, are either there's always been a contingent reality that's just always coexisted by the supernatural will of truth, or this is another free will choice, by the way. It could have always made it to be. It could have had it begin in time, which is what I believe, and I'm about to prove why I believe that outside of the Bible. And then it could have just chosen not to have any contingent reality at all. So there's 3 options, actually. So it kind of reinforces that there's...
I'm not sure what you mean by contingent reality.
So that's the unnecessary reality. So necessary reality is truth, right? It's the underlying assumption of everything that there is being. Because before you can make any claim...
Are you using the word being?
That which has existence, that which is. So not like a human being where that is talking about existence, but we use that phrase of a person. But a rock has being because it exists. Sorry if I didn't, I probably should have been more thorough with my definition. Being is that which exists, truth's the purest existence, it's the standard for existence.
I've always thought myself that truth has to be a person.
Mm-hmm.
You've actually taken it further and said truth has to be 3 persons.
Yes.
Very interesting.
I'm not the first person to do this. I'm not going to pretend to take credit for this.
But if physical, how can it be a person since people are physical?
No,
but is our personhood physical? Now, I agree that we are physical, but are we purely physical? And is our personhood a physical thing? Can you hold our personhood? Can you sense it physically? You can experience its expression. This is really interesting because there is a physical expression of truth. That's what we are. Now, we also are autonomous to a degree. We have our own wills, so we can choose to disobey that design. I can be like, you know what? I don't want to be orderly. I don't want to represent truth. And then I can have disordered wills. And that would be the standard of morality. And I know you guys got a lot of questions. We are at the hour. I do want to kind of wrap things up, okay. But then we can just try to save your questions. I do want to hear them all. But contingent reality, I believe it's created on the foundation that it is lesser than time. It is subject to time, and it changes, and it has an end. All of these things point to it having a beginning. The purpose is the communication of ultimate truth, because that is the greatest virtue, is ultimate truth, which is always self-communicating. It's self-fulfilled. It's its own beginning and end. But it also provides a beginning and an end, or purpose. Not a ceasing, but it's its own purpose. The Greek word telos, T-E-L-O-S is how it's transliterated. Super fascinating word for philosophy. It's really worth studying. It's a biblical word. When you see in the New Testament it talks about end, normally it's using that word. It's not talking about the ceasing like we talk about today, but it's the goal or the fruition of something. So because it changes in time, it cannot transcend time. It can't be greater than time. And because it has an end, it's going to stop changing. Maybe if it always changed, like there was a principle of constant change within it, that could always be that way, which kind of is irrational to have a constant inconstancy. It's kind of a paradox. So I guess it's not really a possibility. But if it actually gets to a point where it would stop, well, then it is subject to time. It doesn't transcend time. It's not eternal. However, that doesn't mean it can't exist forever. It just means it had to have begun. So it has a final state, and that is the complete expression or revelation. That's just the taking away of a veil to reveal something, to make it evident. Basically, it's to know God. It is the end of all things. It's the purpose of all things. And because of its finiteness, its limitations, I do not believe it can be from eternity past. It's not co-eternal with God. It is a created thing. Originally, I was going to try to keep it purely explicitly theological and just explain the logic and then show why I believe it lines up with God. But the reality is it's much quicker and it's much... I feel like it's more concrete, or I think it's more concrete to explain it as God, because now we're not talking about some vague thing, we're being more specific. Of course, God is vague in many ways, depending on who your audience is, but I think we can understand that God exists as the ultimate. So this is a created thing, so within the Christian worldview, with being my worldview, and there are variations of Christianity, there are different legitimate Christian worldviews. They're not... You don't have to believe an exact line of reasoning in all ways to be saved or to be within the camp of Christian, but there's essential elements to what makes Christian Christian.
Saved from
what? In the Christian context, salvation from the sinful nature that we have inherited and that we have, and salvation from the condemnation of our giving in to that sin nature. So when we choose to sin. The Bible teaches that we have an inclination to sin since the first sin. We tend to be disorderly, but we can choose, and it says that we've all, at some point or another, we've all fallen short, we've all chosen something that is disorderly. And truth being just, and that it's going to reveal itself, is actually not the best news, because that means the problem of evil isn't going to be a problem for long. It doesn't mean we're going to cease to be. It means we're going to find out what order is that we've rejected, and that's going to look like misery. That's the Christian worldview. It's going to look like hell. That's what the word is used to describe. That's what it means, is personal divorce from God, but you don't cease to exist. And this isn't some overblown act of pettiness. It is the right treatment for something that has rejected the greatest good there is. You can't have good apart from God because God's the standard of good. Right? You can't. There's a C.S. Lewis quote, you can't have joy apart from God because there is no such thing. He's the author of it. Now, you might experience pleasure as a non-believer, but lasting joy is something that comes from God. And in the end, there will be no joy without God. It's like wanting to be refreshed without having a drink. It's not that it's being withheld from you by anyone but yourself. And when you choose to reject the only thing that can cure the issue you have, if you're sick and there's a cure, and you say, well, I want to be better, but I don't want that cure, and it's a terminal sickness that will guarantee kill you, you have no one to blame but yourself if you don't take that cure. Now, what happened at the cross, what I believe about Jesus' death and his resurrection, the punishment of disorderliness is, or of rebellion against God, I don't mean a mistake, I mean willful wrong. The punishment for that is death. That's what the Bible teaches. Is it the wages? Well, what did I just say? What
did
I just explain?
God was like infinite mercy a while ago?
No, I said God's infinite and that mercy is a virtue of God. I never said he was infinite mercy. That is, that's a logical leap. To say that mercy is a virtue is not to say the same that never ceasing mercy on something that rejects it is a virtue.
Well, I mean, he's let seemingly every single heinous crime in the last recent amount of history go by.
That's because everyone before the recent amount of history has already died and been judged. Everyone who's alive hasn't died yet. Death's the punishment for every heinous sin. And everyone's going to die. But what happens, death isn't the ceasing of being in Christianity. I'm speaking from my worldview now, my beliefs from the Bible. What the Bible teaches is that death is separation from God. Now, when man first sinned in the Garden of Eden, are you familiar with that story? Okay, so when he first sinned, he died that day. And we go, and a lot of people say, well, the Bible's wrong because it contradicts itself because it has Adam living for hundreds of years, yes, hundreds of years, after he sinned. And it's like, well, no, it's not wrong because he and God were divorced. And that's a true death, is separation from God, and on a personal level. Now, physically, he's still being given, there's still a grace, there's a decay, but there's still a grace and a mercy that keeps us from from hell, really. But when we die, then we stand before God. And is it heaven or hell? Now, how on earth do we get to heaven, right? Because we've all sinned. We've all deserved hell. We've rejected the good. The one thing that can deliver us from our own bad choices is the very thing we're saying no to. It's like being thirsty and refusing a glass of water and complaining about your thirst. It's ridiculous. But this is the whole point, is God took on the nature of a created man who it's very important that man represents God to the world. Because the broken state of everything in the world is linked to man. Because man was made head of the world. That's in Genesis 1. He was called he was told to rule it and to subdue it. He was given dominion over the earth. So man's disorder brought disorder on what he was in charge of. That's what stewardship is. Everything he was responsible for that belonged to him by the as a gift from God, he threw away. God said, you may have done this. You're going to suffer now as a result of being separated from me because you rejected me. But I will send a savior who will crush the serpent's head, the serpent being Satan, who tempted them to eat the fruit. Now, they gave in, so they're responsible for that, but Satan is the one who tempted them. So they're punished with their curse, and Satan's punished with his curse. It says, the woman's seed will crush the serpent's head. And what's phenomenal about this verse is the seed is not from woman. In the Bible, there's only two passages where it attributes the seed to the woman. Everywhere else, it's to the man. Those two passages, the one in Genesis, where it's the promise of the Savior. The other one, there was an illegitimate child, and they were essentially disinherited, so they weren't considered their father's seed, so it was attributed to the mother. But that's obviously a new scenario.
Whose child?
Abraham and So Abraham and Sarah.
Hagar?
Yes. Abraham and Sarah were married, but God promised them a child, which was part of the promise of the Messiah. It's the same promise being extended. And they didn't have that child. They were very old. Sarah was like, I don't think God's really going to do this through us. So, you know, I have a maidservant. You can guess where things went. Not good. It was the wife's idea, which really makes that messed up. But anyway, they have a child. I mean, it's not any better if it's the husband's idea, is it? But the whole thing's messed up situation. But actually, there's a really cool story about that. So they're rejected, right? They're cast out. Well, Abraham's the one God that's been making promises to. They're cast out of Abraham's family. So Abraham, out of his camp, yep. Abraham was the one who was told that his seed would basically, he'd be the ancestor of Christ, is pretty much what he was told. And he was kind of kicked out of that family. And it wasn't even her fault, right? But she dealt with the consequence of other people's sins. Well, her and her son were not in a good situation. They were dying of thirst, but God provided a well for them. And at that well, Hagar calls it, can't remember the name of the well. This actually is going to come up in the book I want to write that I don't know if I'll ever actually write.
Oh, let it go.
But it's called the, it translates to the well of the God who sees. Because rather than say, God, my suffering's your fault, and attributing it to him when it was man's fault, God is not the one who did that. He may have allowed it to happen, but he's not the one who did that. She says, God, you've seen me in my need. I cried out to you, and you gave me water to sustain me. And that's a very beautiful picture of what God does for us is when we sin, when we're hurting, whether or not it's our sin or someone else's. God provides, and God sees, and God cares. And I've had those days like everyone else where it's like, does he see me now? My whole world's broken. I don't feel like living very long right now. What on earth do you mean he sees? But I'm still here. And he's seen and seeing me through every day. I'm still held together. I'm still here to see other people who bear his image, who I see have value, who I'm called to value, and who show value to me. They say, yeah, there is something behind all of this. There is meaning. Basic truth, as silly as it sounds, to say, yeah, truth is true. Reality's real. You don't have to keep believing the nonsense of subjectivism, pantheism, whatever. Because all those other religions, they all devolve to the same nonsense. The only truth that is ultimate and final is God. And God has made us to know him and to make him known. Because he has chosen to express himself, and he does not change. And, that's what he did at the cross. That's what the Messiah came to do. He didn't come to reign and conquer everyone and to throw all the heathen out of the land. He came, and he talked to people, and he loved people. He went to the outcasts. He went to the sinners. He went to the people who lived very bad lives, and he showed them kindness. And he's well known for some pretty brutal remarks against those in authority who were not good people. He called, I believe it was Herod, he called a fox in a very demeaning way. He refers to the Pharisees and Sadducees, all sorts of things. Whitewashed sepulchers, the idea being that on the outside they look nice, they're whitewashed, but they're a pit of death. He called them broods of vipers. He called them all sorts of things to say, you guys are evil. You wish to bring people to death and to hell. And that's what you do. And he didn't mince any words about it. He told them flat out. Because he's not interested in outward righteousness. He's interested in taking the broken, the dirty, the guilty, and the undeserving, like you and me, and bringing them back to union with truth without condemnation. And that's what happened, is he took the condemnation on himself. So he could remain just, he could punish sin, and he could still communicate himself in such a way where we could enjoy him. That's what the gospel is, that Jesus died for the sins of men. And he rose again, showing that he had power over death, that we could be risen again with him. That's why we believe in a resurrection of everyone. Because he rose from the dead, and we have multiple hundreds of witnesses who claim to have seen him. And we have people die for the belief that they had themselves seen the risen Savior who they knew was dead. That's pretty hard to explain if none of this is true?
Amen. On the note of what, in fact, you might have been thinking about this verse when you were speaking there. You know, I just thought of what he said about, you know, what about all the evil that's been done, and God let all that evil happen. And I thought of this verse in Romans. God presented Christ as a sacrifice of atonement through the shedding of his blood to be received by faith. He did this to demonstrate his righteousness, because in his forbearance, he had left the sins committed beforehand unpunished. He did it to demonstrate his righteousness at the present time, so as to be just and the one who justifies those who have faith in Jesus. So God didn't punish sin before the time of Christ. In mm-hmm. his forbearance, he was patient. Then he did punish sin mm-hmm. on the cross. Let me just continue. Mm-hmm. And now we have a choice, those of us who are alive now, we have a choice to accept that punishment, mm-hmm. right? Like, we can say, yes, my sin was punished on the cross, and I believe that, and I'm putting my faith in that. Or we can choose not to accept that punishment, and the only logical conclusion is yep. that we will receive a punishment in the future.
Right. All disorder must be reordered, and either right. that'll be punishment or it will be redemption. And by the way, the believers are called to die daily. That was written by Paul under inspiration of the Holy Spirit, which is not referred to physical death, because obviously you can't keep dying every single day, but it's a dying to self. It's sacrifice. And that's why I was trying to point out earlier, is actually sacrifice is at the heart of morality in a broken world. That's how it applies. Because when you value someone, you're a finite creature, and the reality is your relationship to truth is kind of broken right now, but when you have God, you can give and give and give and not be given back by anyone but God. And even if you die in this world, even if you are barren and poor and destitute, you owe nothing in this world, and you die, you will have rewards in heaven by the grace of God. And that's an amazing thing to think about, is Christianity isn't just about, well, I'm not going to hell. Hell's really the small thing. Heaven's the great big thing. Heaven's the awesome thing, because all the things we enjoy in this life are foretastes of heaven. They're all about God's goodness being communicated. Hell isn't the thing that good is the absent of, right? We're not looking to a... Heaven isn't this blank white place. It's... read Revelation. It is a place of beauty. It is a place of gemstones, of pure gold street, so pure you can see through it like it's glass. And it will be not... the new heavens and new earth, by the way, not just the heaven, but they're going to be brought back into the union, which is actually a theme in the Bible. But we're getting off topic. It's about 20 minutes over. But over, sorry. But long story short, the grace of God is this. Sin deserves death. But God doesn't want us to die, even if we keep... And I say deserve, and then, well, it's true. Really, sin necessitates death. It causes death by its very nature. It separates you from God, right? Disorder separates you from truth, right?
Wait.
Because if
truth... Sin... Wait, what did you just say? Something about death?
Truth is the source of being, right?
You mean like source of existing?
Yeah, truth's what gives us existence. Because for existence to be true, it has that relationship to truth. Truth's the ground.
Okay.
So truth is reasonable. It is rational. It's the ground for reason. You don't have an argument without a premise, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you reject reason, which comes from truth, then you are necessarily rejecting truth by extension. Which means you are choosing lies. When you reject truth, truth is the source of all good things, truth is the source of existence, and it caused goodness to communicate itself.
What do you mean communicated itself?
To make a way for it to relate to us, to give us fuller existence.
How does truth give us fuller existence?
By every good thing. Every good thing is a deepening of our existence, of our being.
Wait, why did you point to the spirit?
Oh, I was pointing to this clock as a whole. I'm sorry. Because this is relation, this is communication. These are, God has always been in communication with himself, is the argument over here.
Wait, is that connected to the truth discussion of 2 seconds ago?
Yeah, it's all connected. Okay. Have you seen that? Have you seen that meme where, where it's like the conspiracy theorist and it's like it's all connected? That's just basically kind of what's going on here. But
well, how do you explain? So if truth is
truth always
reason, how do you explain its connection to God using reason?
No, truth is not reason. Truth's the ground for reason. We get reason from truth, just like we have an argument with the premise. Truth's the ultimate premise. Reason's the arguing. Truth. Being called God is more or less a title for truth. Truth is being that is self-existent, and because it exists, it must have relationship, because nothing can meaningfully exist without relating, because you can't have a definition without some sort of relation. You can't define anything without using something to relate it to. I just think of anything that you want to define and don't relate it to anything. It doesn't make sense, because every word you use is an attempt to relate things. That's what I'm doing right now. That's what we do every time we talk. We assume relationship, and that's why I'm saying when we talk, we're arguing for the Trinity without knowing it. Or we're providing a proof for the Trinity without knowing it.
What's so, the connection to the Trinity and truth?
Relationship has three elements. You have someone who relates, someone who is related to, and the union of relation between the two.
So are you using Trinity as an example?
Trinity is the Christian idea, the Christian term for this basic logic here.
It's kind of the ultimate manifestation.
Right. So this is,
You're at least showing that the Christian belief is logical.
Well.
Right. I'm pretty
logical. Yes. I'm arguing that it's strict, that, most of this is strictly necessary. The gospel is a little harder to prove strictly necessary, and we're well over time. But I'm just going to try to...
We're in question and answer time.
Well, yeah, I guess we pretty much are. Is it okay if we keep... Can that go on indefinitely?
Fine, yeah. I actually had...
well, that case...
A suggestion.
You got anything you said before, not 3:30.
Well,
no, I was joking.
It wasn't an hour.
Okay.
For this... section of time, but if there's interest in the room to continue, I have no addition to that. I'm not in any hurry. But I have a suggestion that I'd like to offer. Don't let this cut this conversation short. Mm-hmm. But I think this is a conversation that ought to go on another time. So with the two of you guys, Larson and Ken, like meet up, buy you lunch at your favorite place. We'll take a 3-hour lunch. You want to do that sometime, Ken?
Who's paying?
Me.
Oh, that's good.
Generous.
No, I'm a Baptist. I'm always up for lunch.
Yes. Okay, let's do it.
So the basic argument, though, I'll just try to summarize it one last time. Truth, ultimate truth, is existence as it is, and other things that exist have a likeness to truth because of their existence.
Mm-hmm.
It's the archetype of existence. Other things are like it, but not it. Relation is necessary for meaningful existence or actual existence. So for truth to be, it must have relationship. Truth, if it's truly ultimate, can't be a contingent thing. It can't be dependent on anything else. It has to, that's what aseity is, it's self-existence. So for it to possess aseity.
What's aseity?
It's in its total independence from anything at all in order to exist. So, it's a hard thing to explain. This roof is held up by the walls, right?
Uh-huh.
That is dependency.
Oh, uh-huh.
A child's dependent on a mother, okay? But we're all dependent on the laws of physics to hold our bodies together.
Uh-huh.
And all these other things. Well, those are all different kinds of dependencies. Ultimate truth, if it's truly ultimate, if it is the truth that we are discussing as the groundwork for reality, it can't be dependent on anything else. But since relationship is necessary for existence, and truth has aseity, it must have relationship within itself.
You lost me.
That's lunch.
So, yeah, I think so. There has to be oneness and distinction within truth. It has to be one thing with three relations, or with multiple relations, but... I would argue that it's three because of the structure of relationship. But that's all right. It is not a simple concept. I've had to hear the exact same things multiple times over before I could get to the point where I understood it. But after, there's just a point where it clicks, and that'll happen differently for different topics for different people. But once it clicks, it's like, I get it now, and that's cool.
I feel like you just swallowed every book that's ever been written.
Actually, I use a lot more internet than you'd think. I should read more books. But the internet is a powerful tool if you use it correctly. Memes are funny, but not useful for this topic. So, yeah, I think that's pretty well summarized. What is, just a quick overview, worldview is what you actually believe to be true. What must be is truth. These are the qualities of it. My worldview is Christian. I believe in the gospel. I believe in the redemption. I believe in the fall. And I believe in what's called the glorification or glory. You can think of glory, love, and expression in the context of God. You can think of those as all the same thing. Because the expression of God is all of these things. And within these persons, he has always been doing all of this. And basically all that goodness that comes from God that we have in delicious flavors and wonderful smells, everything that we enjoy in life, he wants that for us and more. Things that we, to enjoy him directly, not indirectly, but to personally know him fully. And that's the promised end for those who want to be part of good. So, the biggest thing is saying, yeah, I'm not good, but I want good, and I want to change. I want God's forgiveness. I want to come back to him, and I want to know him. And the day you make that choice, everything changes, and it's a choice that is crucial. There's no greater choice than that.
I was going to ask another question.
Wait, wait, I want to hear what he has to say. He's been asking it for a while.
Do you?
A little bit later ago, you said truth was like a person.
Yeah, it's three persons. So you've heard of, we've talked about the Trinity before. Well, and your family's been talking about it, I know that. So the Father, the Son, and the Spirit, they're three persons, but they're one being. So personhood and being, this is just a quick, simple proof. And I think it's important for apologetics, we know the difference.
What's apologetics?
The defense of what one believes, or namely a faith. So Christian apologetics is defense of the Christian religion through logic and argument. It's not like using shields and swords. But that can be fun too. So a rock. Is a rock a person? Does a rock have existence?
Yeah.
Well, definitely, right? Rocks are real things. It's a meaningful word. So a person is not the same as existence. They're not interchangeable terms. Something can exist without being a person, but if it's really anything, it exists. But there's nothing that says they're the same thing, which means how can you actually disprove that multiple persons being one being's illogical? How can you make that argument that they three persons can't be one being?
So do you not find a person as a physical?
No, I don't. Personhood can't be physical.
One, what are you and me?
We have physical form. We are physical beings in part, but we're not just physical. We have minds, and you can talk about the different things that happens organically, but the concepts that the concepts themselves and the eternal qualities, well, from speaking from a Christian perspective, not necessarily from the necessary, not in the necessary context, but from the Christian perspective, we have more than just bodies. And our personhood is not a matter of our body.
Can't get into this discussion tonight because it's immense and it's rapidly evolving. But we think of ourselves as a person, as a fleshy being, but we're 99.997% empty space. It's been and it's perplexed people who have studied that issue for a long time. But what they're discovering with the help of quantum computers is an understanding that what we really are in our personal existence is a matrix of different vibrational frequencies that interact in such a way that, you know, some of the vibrations cause us to have what we feel as bones, as skin, as teeth.
that might be also a little too complicated of an explanation.
But it also ties into our soul. They're all one. In other words, our soul isn't separate from our fleshy body. It's all connected by vibrational relationships that cause us to be a human instead of a tree. A tree has its own set of vibrations.
There's a literal energy that is distinct.
Right.
But I
and the beauty of it all is all the vibrations have to be generated from something.
Mm-hmm.
Vibrations come from something. They don't happen by themselves. So there has to be a generator.
Right.
And therefore it all ties back to the generator, which we call God.
Right. There's a lot of different titles for God in Christianity. Yeah. And he's understood to be the giver of life.
That's correct.
He is actually the yeah, when man is created, it describes him as being made from the dust of the earth. And the Hebrew for man and ground, they're actually related words. Man is Adam. That's why the first man was called Adam. He was called man. That's basically what it means. But the ground is Adama, which shows the link in the Hebrew language and the understanding between man and the earth,
yes.
His domain. It's very fascinating to get into that, but that's kind of outside the scope of this. But yeah, we're not just physical, and we know we're not just physical because we have non-physical thoughts, and we have opinions, and we have
emotions.
We have emotions. Mm-hmm. We have these things that are not physically quantifiable. You cannot find the solid state of anger. You can't find the matter of anger. You can't find the matter of joy. You can find chemicals that work in our bodies that explain what's going on the physical side to make our bodies respond to emotions or to interact with them, but the emotions themselves are metaphysical. And the physical being contingent would actually make it less real than the non-physical. So that's kind of a weird thing to think about, because what we primarily experience that we're aware of is the things we physically experience, because physical sensation is overwhelming. But it's not all there is, and we experience metaphysical things all the time that we just don't think about in those terms. Not because that's how humans think, but because of how materialism thinks, and it has been a prevailing influence in our society for a long time. And it's materialism is one of the dumbest beliefs in the world, because it's essentially the belief that there are no beliefs. Everything's matter, including this concept, which has no material form.
It's crazy, yeah. We should wrap up, Ken.
All right.
So let's do one thing. And you want to do another round sometime?
Scheduling might be hard, but we can figure out something.
Okay. but excellent, Ken.
But I would like to have a further conversation.
Yeah, good job. Very good.
Good job.
I just
wanted
to make sure I had a question. I didn't have one.
You didn't have one?
Yeah,
okay. I didn't make sure. Yeah.